Accession number 12661, Mr. Jim Ray, reel 13.
When they started to sweat, it was really hot.
You mentioned, yeah.
Yes. And we did very, very few exercises, except when it was a cool day in the evening, you know. Except we did a lot of swimming, played football when possible, but we had to keep ourselves a bit much undercover during the hot season. Guard duties were just the same, and particularly at the governor's palace.
What would a guard be like at the governor's palace? Then?
Quite good. There's plenty of cover, and the same beat used to be up the main gates. The palace was situated on the banks of the Nile, Gordon's Palace. Actually, there's quite a lot to be said about the palace. We had the great grandson of the Mahdi. He was more or less an aide-de-camp to the governor, and I had the opportunity of having to walk inside the palace, his residence. At the time, he was somewhere else at the moment. But it was occupied because his daughter was there. Spacious inside, but of course it wasn't like it in the days when Gordon was there, because the only evidence of the fort is the steps on which he was assassinated, and they are inside the palace. They are kept there as a memento, you know, a memorial to him. Actually, the steps and the railings down, you know, and the door. But that's it. That's just in the concrete palace itself. There's nothing behind it. There's quite an array of Sudanese weapons on the walls, put out in different patterns, you know, what they used to use in those days. Spears, assegais, swords, different kinds of things. It quite looked beautiful inside, all white.
So the palace was one thing. What about the actual barracks you were in, Khartoum barracks? What were they like?
They were very low. Very low, long barracks. Bricks, built by bricks. There's quite a distance between the roof and the top of the walls, you know, around the area, the barracks, for ventilation. That was one form of ventilation. We had the louvre doors, as usual, and the roofs were made of wood, but there was felting on. That was what I could imagine at the time, for a casual inspection. The barrack rooms are just the same as ordinary barracks. We had the beds, you know, and the lockers. Plenty of room, and quite plenty of cool air. A veranda at the back and one at the front. And in particular, outside of our barrack room, there was a concrete model of a troop ship.
What was that for?
Well, that was when we went there. There's smoke coming out the funnel. They lit the funnel, then they left. So that's how close the people were of going out, and how people coming in. And they used to call. I think the ship is made of concrete. It'd be about 2 or 3 feet long and wide, proper model, and. I forget what was on the side of the ship. It was the good ship, and good ship, it's your turn next for Blighty on the side. So it was the jumping off place. And I don't know how many times every regiment prior to us arriving there would put a little bit of fire in there to let the smoke come out the funnel, because they were going home. And we used to keep that clean and get it nicely swept and kept it in order. We had a very good swim pool. The water was pumped out of the Nile, River Nile. We had two orderlies who should look after the swim pool in general. It was open air. We spent most of our time there, really. We had the opportunity with our regimental sergeant major. We had a fishing trip down the Nile to the 21st or 22nd cataract on the Nile, the dam. That was on the Nile steamer. That was the Anglo-Egyptian navigation company. That was a big paddle steam back, paddles were going. And that was that was very pleasant. It was interesting. We arrived at the dam and pulled in the side. And I think there was two civilians on board, and one was the engineer of the dam and his wife. And they lived near the dam. We fished off the dam. It was supposed to be for Nile bass. That was the fish in there, but we weren't very successful. And to see the water coming through the ducts of the Nile, it was a wonderful sight. There's some power behind it, and you could walk across from one side to the other, because it was in a big, like a bow shape, And I think it must have been about 3/4 mile long, and a terrific height from the river, looking down on it. And after that, we packed up. We had a meal on board, and packed up, turned around, and went back. And it's quite the blue and the white Nile. They converge together at Khartoum, and as you're travelling on the paddle steamer, when you look, you can't see the blue and the white Nile, for the simple reason the white Nile carries a lot of white silt in the water, while the blue Nile is more clearer, and you have a reflection of the blue sky, and you can see the dead line where they both converge straight blue and white. That was very extraordinary. If a camera with coloured film, it would have been a wonderful photograph to bring back home and bring to one side for a memento. Now,
were there any other trips like that you made?
Yes, we went to the bandmaster organised the camel trip. At the time we went to the cool stations, the place called Gabit, the hill station, the Red Sea Hills, and where it was cooler down there than it was at the Khartoum. And he organised a camel trip out into the desert. And that was rather, I wouldn't say pleasant, because riding on a camel's back is pretty awkward, because it keeps lurching backwards and forwards. On the front, you sit with one leg round the pommel at the front, and you hold on tight, and there's one at the back, and if you with the lurching, you get a pain in the back with the pommel digging in your back, and you got one in the stomach. And the camel, you know, it goes down in about three motions. It, just like as though it being lifted up with a jack, so it goes forward, backwards, and then it levels up on the top. We carried our own water supply, and we went right out the desert. And during the time it set off, we had camel drivers as well, you know, walking along in the front and in line. And the one in front of me, and the bugler Burns was on that one, and I think the camel was a bit awkward. And suddenly had a turn of bad temper, and it broke loose from the handler, and it galloped off at full speed, and it turned to the right very suddenly, and it flung Burns right up in the air, and he flopped down on the deck. Whap. What he did, and he did a cloud of dust. we all stopped. Camels went down for a rest. We'd gone for about 4 or 5 miles then, out, you know, from the barracks. The bandmaster rushed over. The bandmaster rose in his little shorts and little hairy brown legs. "Are you all right, Burns?" I went to have a look at him. Burns sat up and he shook his head. And spitting grit out, you know. Because there's a lot of scrub land there as well. And pulling bits of thorns out. "Yes, sir, I think I'm all right." He was in Northumberland. "Yes, sir. I think I'm all right. Now, would you like me to take you back? Would you like to go back to barracks? No, are you sure?" "Oh, yes, sir, I'm all right." He shook himself because he was a little stocky built chap, you know. "I'm all right, sir, thank you. Would you like a drink of water?" you look up in a terrible state, and there's like, you know, grit and scratches and little bits. "Oh," and he twisted himself down, and powder coming off him. He put his hat back on again. "Right, I'm all right." And then the camel was still groaning and growling, you know, and he, when he went towards the camel, he kicked it in the ribs. Boom, just like it was doing, boom, boom. And she said, "And that's for thou." Mounted, came out of the camels, and off he went again. Oh dear, I also remember him. Oh, he went up in the air, you know, a camel from the ground, it's about 7 feet, you know what I mean, it height. Went through him, he was shot up in the air like a big fat frog. Wham! Anyway, we set off again, and we contacted the Sudanese Defence Force. They were Sudanese. And Gibeet, it's close to the border of the Italian Somaliland, you know. And of course, we didn't go anywhere near the border. The border was pointed out by one of the guards who could speak very good English. Well, we had a rest there, and we had a look around, and the camels had water. There's big water troughs, see, for the camels, and spent about half an hour there. And some of the chaps were having a smoke and mounted again. Then we went to a place called Obeid, El Obeid. Well, that was a big wireless station. Outpost, and it must have been a chief of something. And he had a big encampment there, you know. He had the camels and horses there, and he invited us in the tent for some food, and we had black Arabian coffee. Sweet and sticky, and then we had a glass of water to wash it down, you know. And the food we got were sheep's eyes. And
what were they like?
Well, gristly.
You ate them then?
I tried one, but that was I got one down to be polite. You know, you had to eat something anyway. And hard-boiled eggs and black coffee and some sort of a hard-core bread. They gave it a name, but I forget what it was called. Just like hard, crusty bread. Something like an Indian chapati, but a bit thicker. Unleavened bread. And we had that. And more coffee, and more water, and then we returned to the barracks. Well, that was quite a good day. I liked that trip. It's not too bad, except for that unfortunate incident with Bob Burns. We could have a game of football. It was quite cool there. And the water supply at Gabit, it was good fresh water, but it had an alkali taste because it pumped out of the ground. You see, fresh water. It was what they call an artesian well, and it was pumped out by the air windmill and pumped up into a big tank. The water was tepid water, and that was the only fresh water we had for drinking purposes and having a swill down, you know, a wash. I think we were there for about 2 or 3 weeks. And the features of the hill, we had a walk around the hills. Cup Badge Hills. The units who had been there before us, they put their cup badges on the side of the hill, and they're all white boulders and stones. Different regiment, the cap badges, and that was very interesting. We went up and had a look around, and came back. We had one. The NCOs had one exercise really, and it was making a topographical study of the area, the Red Sea Hills, and the railways. The railway run through. Through the town, Gabit, the town. We weren't allowed to go into it at all. They had the minarets up and things like that, and they used to have camel races. You could see the camel races from a distance.
So how many of you had gone to Gabit?
Well, there was...
It was just a holiday, it was not a...
Well, it was a holiday plus a few exercises and... Trips out, you know.
And about how many?
Well, the company, the band and the mules, and a few more attachments with us. So the NCOs, we made a study of the topographical area, and. Put in the gradients, just like a map, you know, made a proper map out of it. And well, that was all we did really. It was to get out of the heat and a refresher.
How did you get on with the local population? You said you didn't see much of the Arabic population at Gabit.
The Fuzzy Wuzzies.
Or the yes, any of the locals.
No, we didn't mix with them at all. No, strictly apart from each other.
So you lived with your fellow soldiers. You
yes. Well, you couldn't help but rub shoulders with them in Khartoum itself, because Khartoum is like a small city, you know. There's restaurants there. One was owned by two Greeks, and you got a good meal there. I don't think there was a cinema. I can't remember a cinema there at all. No, I don't think so there was. Of course, there was a wireless station at Khartoum. I sent a cable to my sister. She got married while I was out there, and I sent a cable to congratulate her when she got married, and she got it. Let's see now. There was Gordon's College, and a statue of General Gordon.
Now, who were your particular friends in the regiment at the time, you know, during your service in India and then at Sudan?
Well, the same pack. A couple of bandsmen and one or two buglers, Alf Howes and myself and Sam Galton.
And you'd hang around with those most of all, would you?
Well, we kept in company, myself and Harrison. We were more or less chums all together.
Were there any particular characters in the regiment that stood out, you know, eccentrics or people with strong personalities that you remember?
I don't think so. I can't put my finger on any of the peculiarities. I mean, they're all quite all right.
Now, what about the... You don't sound as if you did much work at all while you were in the Sudan.
No, not much at all.
You'd be doing your normal bugler duty, I presume.
Oh, yes. There's a guard duty every day on the palace. Yes.
What about the guard on the barrack guard? There'd be a barrack guard as well, would there?
Well, it wasn't necessary because it was all open ground, you see, and everything was... self-contained within the barrack area. There was no, there wasn't such a thought of being attacked or anything like that, you know, any being molested or any marauders, you know, it was quite civilised at the time. But
so
the guard was the typical thing every day.
So in... when was it? November 1937, you came back home. Were you pleased to leave the Sudan, or how did you feel?
Well, I was...
Because you were coming to the end of your service as
oh,
well.
Oh, yes, I knew that when I went home, I was finished at the start. But
but the whole regiment was going home, or the whole battalion
was
going
yes,
home.
We were all going in block, yes, to...
Would many of you be time expired?
Of course, those who joined up at the same time as myself, of course, that was about 1937, you see, they would be in different companies. They would be launched into civilian life again, same as myself.
So about a sixth of the battalion would be packed up?
More than that, because there's four companies, you see. And I couldn't say how many other people went into civil life alongside myself.
So what about the journey back then?
We had to retrace our steps and another train journey back to Port Sudan and get a boat there. And go back to England. I don't think there's any other incidents I can remember in Khartoum at all.
But what about the journey? Anything special? Or was
no.
It just a normal troop ship journey?
Just a normal troop ship journey home.
And where did you go when you got home? Back to Woking, was it?
Woking, yes. Yes.
That's where they were going into barracks, was it?
Yes, went into barracks and got sorted out and we got our final payment and that was it.
Was there any talked question of staying on for some more. You've done your 6 years, but what about, was there any, did you ever think of staying in the army?
I might have done, but while I was away, my father died when I was in India. And mother, she was left a widow, and I had two brothers. My sister was already married, of course, and she was on her own. And I went back to look, keep things right at home, you see. I was a senior. I don't know whether my mother had any problems with my two brothers anyway, because there's three brothers. There's Tom, Albert and John.
And that's what made you decide not to stay in, but you'd have liked to.
I would have done, yes.
Were you given any special advice about going back into civilian life, or any courses of how to behave, you know?
Well, not particularly. That's rather surprised. Some chaps who could get vocational training, you see, that to get them primed up for a job in when they got home. Well, I didn't get any offer of any vocational training at all.
Why do you think that was?
Well, I think they supposed that I would stay on and complete 21 years service. But it didn't happen that way. Some of the lads, they were cross-posted, and they rejoined the 1st Battalion. They were going to China. They were stopping on to make a career of it. I know Harrison did. He went to China. And Alfowles came out at the same time as myself. Hawkins, he joined up with me. He went back to Durham City. He belonged there with me.
So what were you planning to do when you got back? Where was the family home at the time?
Rainton, a place called Rainton, yes.
And what did you plan to do? You'd been a miner. Well, they'd moved there from fence houses, had they?
Oh, yes.
While you were out in the army?
Yes.
I mean, what did you plan to do?
Look after the family generally.
And what job? Were you going to go back to the mine? Or?
I went back to the mine.
Which mine did you go into?
It was called the Meadows Quarry, very close by the village.
And was there a coal cutting machine there, or what were you on?
Well, I didn't go into that directly because I was like more or less a greenhorn, you know what I mean? I had to get back into it, you see. I got the job as a pipe fitting and pump maintenance fitter. I took it after the pumps. It's rather a damp pit, water, you know, I mean, that to be pumped out of through the headings and things like that. Well, I was more or less the mate of mine. He was an old hand at it, you see, and he taught me actually the intricacies of the pumps and how to pack the pumps, look after them generally, keep them in maintenance, how to connect one pipe to another, lengths of pipes and different sections of pipes. Soon got into the way of it.
Was this mainly on the surface, the pumps then?
Underground.
Pumps were underground?
Underground, yes. Underground.
And how did you settle in back into civilian life? Did you have any trouble?
Well, it was a bit off key at the moment, for the time, but gradually I did get into a full swing of it. It was November, you know, when we came back from the Sudan. But I had a few weeks, and I had some money savings, you know, army savings. And I used to do a little bit of training on my own. I used to go around short shorts or slacks on and a cardigan. I used to cut the side for a bit for a run.
Keeping yourself fit
in the frosty air. Plenty of countryside.
You were on the Army Reserve. Did that involve anything? I mean, were you called up once a year?
No.
And how long were you on the pumps before you got back into it?
I was on the pumps about 18 months. And then I went on coal cutting machines.
Was that the same job as you'd had before you went?
Well, not quite. I wasn't a machine man, but I used to be with the machinery, you know.
Doing what?
Cleaning out the undercut and putting sprags underneath so the coal...
That was the same, though, wasn't it?
Practically, anyway. That was my job.